I'm Mark Simpson, and this is Intersection. Republican Dean Cannon represents Winter Park in the Florida legislature, but he's also the Speaker of the State House. One week into this year's legislative session, we talk with Cannon about his priorities and projections for the 60-day gathering, and fiction writers from the new book, 15 Views of Orlando, stop by to talk about their project and collaboration. That's ahead on Intersection. I'm joined by Florida Speaker of the House, Dean Cannon, Republican of Winter Park. He's joining us from his office in Tallahassee. Welcome, Speaker Cannon.
Hey, thanks very much for having me.
Well, the legislative session, of course, began January 10th. Governor Rick Scott gave his second State of the State address. And in that speech, it really did sound like the governor struck a more cooperative tone with lawmakers, a bit different from last year when the governor dictated his agenda somewhat to lawmakers. So I wonder, what's the buzz around Tallahassee and the Capitol to that speech and your own reaction to the agenda that the governor laid out?
Well, I think it clearly reflected that the governor has learned a lot in his first year in office. I didn't think last year he was particularly dictatorial. I think he just didn't, you know, he had a ton of private sector experience, but very limited experience in the public sector. And he's been progressively each ongoing month and season, he's getting better and better. I thought his speech was excellent, had a nice sort of human touch to it. Some of the people he recognized during the speech was very poignant. And his priorities were focused and, I think, on target. So I think we've got a good foundation laid, frankly, for a good session. We're off to a good start, but we've got a few, you know, several weeks left, obviously. But I think on the whole, we're heading in a generally collaborative direction.
Do you think that we're going to see the governor this go-round playing a more active role during the session? And is that something you would welcome?
I would absolutely welcome it. I think that one of the you know, primary differences in a three-branch government with separation of powers and that sort of thing versus the private sector is everyone is compelled to work together. You know, the House has to work with the Senate. The executive branch has to work with the legislative branch. We have the judicial branch to be, watching over both of us. And I think the governor is going to take a more active role. And I think that's productive because he is a very he's a bright person. I thought his budget recommendations and his approach are thoughtful and principle-based. And while he may, you know, take a different approach to solving a problem, whether it's education or healthcare, the more dialogue we have, typically the better end product we get, both between, you know, the House and Senate and each of us with the governor. So I'm confident and optimistic that as he takes a more active role, that will produce hopefully better results at the end of session.
And as far as the House goes, what would you say are your top priorities going forward here during the session?
Well, from a policy perspective, anything and everything we can do to facilitate job creation, especially among small businesses, is top of mind. And from a functional session perspective, I've been pretty clear that the two main obligations we have under the Constitution are to pass a balanced budget and to pass the reapportionment maps, the redistricting process. Those are the only two things that we are required to do by the Constitution. And I think our focus, along with the governor and the Senate, will be on job creation because that continues to be, I think, top of mind and the top need for our state right now.
Well, you mentioned that budget. Of course, the lawmakers facing up to $2 billion shortfall to try to bridge. And Governor Scott did say he wanted to put a lot more money into education, but he wouldn't be able to do that unless there were big cuts to Medicaid payments for hospitals. Do you think, for example, trying to make those big cuts is something that will happen during the session to try to fulfill the governor's request on education?
Well, it's too soon to tell, and a lot of the details will be up to the two appropriations chairmen, Chair Denise Grimsley in the House and Chairman J.D. Alexander in the Senate. But I think that's one of those areas where we share the governor's goal in the House, and I believe the Senate does too, as far as increasing K-12 education funding. The method which we get there probably won't be identical to the governor's approach. We hopefully will take some of his ideas, maybe add our ideas to it, or approach it in a slightly different way. But, you know, I think any area of the budget, whether it's healthcare or education or public safety, we're going to have to make some adjustments because that's what we do every year. And we've got an obligation to do the same thing that, you know, moms and dads do around the dinner table. table or businessmen and women do when they say, hey, we have a lot of, here's our priorities, but we have a limited number of resources, and here's how we're going to prioritize them.
You also mentioned, you know, creating jobs and trying to bring down that unemployment rate that's up near 10%. Governor Scott, in his speech, emphasized encouraging business growth by streamlining government taxes and regulations. This is a line that we've heard out of Tallahassee well since at least Jeb Bush and beyond. Do you think that that is slowly carving away at creating new jobs, making Florida more business friendly, or is there still more to cut back?
Well, I think we have made great progress. We've been encouraged that recently our unemployment numbers dropped ever so slightly, and so that's a good sign that we're on the right path. I think we can probably make some more strides in the area of regulation, perhaps than in taxes. I hope we can reduce the corporate income tax, perhaps a little bit more, or maybe raise the exemption level like we did last year. The three primary obstacles that I think the governor's identified, which frustrate people who want to grow their businesses or create jobs, or when we're trying to recruit companies from other states, are taxation, litigation, and regulation. And so there's probably some tort proposals that will move, a stable regulatory framework. I think most people, including myself, think there's nothing wrong with appropriate regulation to provide for the public safety or protect our environment or any of those necessary things. But the goal should be to make them predictable so that folks know what the rules of the game are, and that stability attracts people willing to say, okay, if I know what the rules are, then I know I can, you know, calculate how I can maybe come to Florida from another state or grow a business that's already in our state.
You know, I this might be a little inside, but I did hear you talk about tort reform in there, and I just remember even back as far as Senate President Tom Lee, that was a top agenda item for him. Is there still a lot more to do in that area?
Well, I think that more than major proposals like Tom Lee and Speaker Alan Bentz at the time, you know, they did the abrogation of joint and several liability. That was kind of a major issue. I think in tort now it's more about fine-tuning it. There's some proposals dealing with expert witness standards or some focused individual tort reforms in areas like medical malpractice or things like that. Rather than the more broad spectrum concepts, I think now those are more fine-tuning. But anything we can do to add stability for businesses helps. You know, if you know, business is about taking calculated risks, and the better we can enable people to predict what those risks might be, the more confident people may be willing to take some of those risks in order to create jobs.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 WMFE-FM. I'm talking with the Speaker of the Florida House, Dean Cannon. I'm Mark Simpson. You can tell us what you think lawmakers' priorities should be during the legislative session on the WMFE Facebook or Twitter pages, or you can shoot an email over to intersection@WMFE.org. Speaker Cannon, you, of course, mentioned those two top priorities overarching this session, passing the budget and also dealing with redistricting. And this is an election year, and I just wonder, you know, what do you think that effect has on the redistricting process? Do you think, does that at all discourage lawmakers from political risk taking because they don't know what their districts or maybe even who their constituents are going to be because these new maps are going to be coming out?
You know, I don't know from a personal perspective because I'm term limited out, so I'm not on the ballot, and I can offer this interesting perspective. It's probably different for each individual legislator. In some cases, it may make people more timid or more reluctant to pursue a bold policy. Perhaps for other people, it may make them more comfortable being aggressive because they feel like, hey, I'm not going to worry about where the district lines are. I'm going to be more ambitious in advancing policies I believe in. So I don't know that it necessarily, in the aggregate, changes the overall temperament of the legislature. I think it probably, more than anything, just crowds out the time clock because of the time on the floor and the time in committees necessary to handle the state House maps, state Senate maps, and congressional maps, coupled with a tough budget year. I think those two things taken together do limit a little bit the bandwidth of what is possible. But I'm not sure that the redistricting in every case will cause that reticence. In other, you know, in some cases, it may embolden people.
Well, redistricting aside, does the fact that you're term limited mean that you can be more aggressive in pushing through your own agenda and also thinking in terms of your legacy as a Speaker of the House?
You know, yes and no. Well, wonderfully, we had a very precise and broad agenda last year with things like Medicaid reform. We got through some really wonderful policy proposals that I think will benefit the state for years. This year, I'm more trying to support the priorities of the governor, my own House members, and my our partners down in the Senate to come up with something that creates jobs, really focus on the main thing. The major policy proposals we advanced were successful last year, and so I think our primary policy focus this year is just on those economic issues. I've tried never to worry about, you know, legacy or anything like that. Just focus on doing exactly everything we can to help the state during this current year, and then we'll let the pontificators decide what they think of it afterwards.
You know, speaking about job creation, obviously this big debate over expanding casino gaming in South Florida is a hot item in Tallahassee. Locally here in Central Florida, Walt Disney World, political leaders like Orlando Mayor Buddy Dyer and Orange County Mayor Teresa Jacobs have come out against it. You've said you're skeptical about this proposition philosophically and expanding casino gaming in the state, but does that leave a sliver of a chance that you might consider it and allow it to go forward?
Well, I think my comments have been pretty consistent. I am skeptical. I've never been comfortable with a statewide expansion of gambling in our state, just from a personal philosophical basis. But unlike the governor, the Speaker of the House, I always try to remind people, you know, I have my personal opinions, but I'm not the only opinion that matters, and I'm trying to be respectful of the process. I think the Senate seems to have more of an appetite for it than the House. And the sponsors of the bills, Representative Eric Frezen from Miami and Senator Ellen Bogdanoff, are solid members. And so it's too soon to tell. I think it's an uphill battle, but I'm trying to not weigh in with any kind of finality, because we really don't know what the end proposal will look like. There's the committee process and amendments get filed. So I'm certainly continue to be skeptical, continue to be of the opinion that that's a big lift in this year because of its complexity and the seriousness with which folks take that issue. But, you know, nothing's off the table till sine die.
Well, just across the rotunda, Senate President Mike Haridopoulos, of course, has come out in favor of this. And I just wonder, is this an issue you think is going to drag on till the final days? And is this going to add strain to your relationship with the Senate President? Last session, there was definitely some tension as things wrapped up sine die.
Well, first of all, I don't think there's certainly no remaining tension, and I think people tended to overvalue the fact that, you know, session ended a couple hours late last time around. Mike's and I have been friends since before I got in this process, and I tend to be friends with him a long time. I think the gaming issue and any other policy issue, we separate from our personal friendship, because, you know, those are policy proposals, and that's one of the great things about our system is, well, two House members or House members and senators can have a great relationship and have a complete diametrically opposed view on any given issue. And that's what I think the voters expect of us, is try and come up with working together the best policy proposals. Our system requires folks to compromise and work together. And that's one of the things that makes our country and our form of government, frankly, better than pretty much anything else on the planet.
Mm-hmm. Senate President Mike Haridopoulos has suggested also the legislature might consider postponing dealing with the budget until later in the spring when the new economic numbers come out. Of course, that's typically the time when the legislature meets, but you have until July to actually approve the budget. So what do you think about that idea that's been floating around that maybe redistricting might get wrapped up sooner or later, or the even postponing budget work until later on?
Well, I've of the opinion that, you know, we always get a revenue estimate during the first week of session. We're going to get one early in this session, and then we'll use that as a basis for coming up with next year's fiscal year budget. And that's how it always happens. I've gotten no indication of any factual basis for extreme unpredictability in the revenue estimate. We always are speculating. That's why they call it an estimate as to what next year's revenues and expenses will be. And I think the people expect us to get our work done on time. Obviously, you know, it takes two to tango. So if the Senate decides not to do it, that's their choice. But I think folks expect us to get our work done on time and be efficient. And I think, frankly, doing our work on time sends that signal of stability and predictability to the business community that they expect. So I've got a lot of confidence in President Haridopoulos and his fellow senators, and I think they'll reach the same conclusion. But, you know, we'll cross that bridge when we come to it.
And just thinking about what might be the end game here in the legislative session and your impact on this region as Speaker of the House, you know, in what ways do you feel that Central Florida has benefited from having someone like you from Winter Park in a leadership position in the legislature?
Well, I can tell you it's paid a lot of dividends in terms of raising our voice and our effectiveness for regional priorities. When I think of things like the approval of the UCF Medical School or the recruitment of the Burnham Institute to come to Central Florida, those are things that will hopefully enhance the economic strength and the improve the overall diversity of our economy for decades to come. Our state and our region has a great history of legislative leadership from Dan Webster to Tony Jennings to Tom Feeney and others. And I feel privileged just to follow those great leaders and get to be speaker. It's been a real honor and in many ways, professionally, the most satisfying and exciting thing I've ever done. But I am looking forward to being done. I believe in the term limit, and I'm looking forward to wrapping up this session.
So am I hearing you say no future political ambitions?
Well, certainly none at this time. You know, you never say never, and I've decided I won't even really think seriously about what I'm going to do next until after session. But I'm pretty much sure it's going to be in the private sector for a number of years, and then, you know, maybe if something opens up in the future, we'll look at it. But I'm not going to make those calls till after session's concluded.
I've been talking with Florida House Speaker Dean Cannon. Sir, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks so much.
Coming up on Intersection, we hear from the writers of the new book, 15 Views of Orlando. Cities such as Paris and New York are richly depicted in literature. You think about Hemingway's A Movable Feast, and on film and TV shows, you've got places like Sex and the City talking about New York. But what about Orlando? You think about Orlando, and not so much. It's a little bit more thin picking. Borough Press is seeking to change that. Borough's a local publisher of literary fiction and creative nonfiction. This month, the publisher releases 15 Views of Orlando, a book that is a collection of 15 interwoven short stories by 15 authors connected to the city. And here to tell us about it is the editor of 15 Views of Orlando, Nathan Hollick. Nathan, good to have you with us.
Great to be here.
And we're also joined by two of the participating authors in the project. We've got Hunter Choate.
Thanks for having me.
And Jay Christopher Sylvia.
Good afternoon.
Great to have you all with us. So the book here, we're really trying to depict what is the real Orlando, separate from the theme parks that so often get the main definition of what this area is like, and kind of give it a phony feel to people who aren't familiar with it. Just recently, we had Orange County Mayor Teresa Jacobs on, and she mentioned that, you know, people think of Orlando as a great place to come and play, but not necessarily to live and work. So I wonder, Nathan Hollick, how do you define what the real Orlando is?
Wow, that's a tough question to start off with. Thank you. How do I define what Orlando actually is? I don't know. I think as you'll see in the book, or as readers will see in the book, that there are a lot of different Orlandos. And that's something that's maybe unique about our city, is that we have I Drive, and then we have downtown, and then we have Disney World, and then we have Universal, and then we obviously have Legoland, and then we have Winter Park. I think we have a lot of different areas, not so much neighborhoods, a lot of them their own independent cities that create this sort of metropolitan Orlando that is overall one giant city, one giant character, but so many small areas, so many small institutions that conflict with one another and that have their own personalities.
And I wonder, Hunter Choate, you know, as a writer tackling what is the real Orlando, do you think about it in terms of, you know, this city is still growing or organically? It didn't come up like a centralized area, like you think of New York, it's got the distinct boroughs,
right,
and they were all
right,
kind of one unit. Do you have to tackle Orlando differently because of that disparate nature?
Well, for me personally, I was zeroing in on a particular area, so I didn't necessarily have that particular challenge. But I think that the unique thing about the book is the fact that it does take those disparate areas, the various voices, and like the city itself, it kind of brings them all together in a greater whole.
What about for you, Jay Christopher Sylvia? How do you picture the real Orlando?
It's interesting, actually. I think Orlando, given the spread to it and the space of it, you can only get a sense of Orlando in that sort of in your experiences that you have in the individual areas, right? So, if you're in Oviedo, your concept of Orlando is going to be very very sort of influenced by that. You know, actually, I was talking with Ryan, the publisher from Borough Press, a little while ago, and we were just discussing how this area in 50 is. It's just so, you know, very different from how we remember it, and it's always, you know, changing. And so, yeah, it's just very different points of views.
Was the idea, Nathan Hollick, to bring out a darker Orlando, maybe that the public doesn't usually think about?
Not necessarily. It's interesting that you mentioned in your intro about how maybe the general public perceives Orlando. One thing I wrote in the introduction to the book is that when I always thought about Orlando in literature and in film, one thing I thought about was Steve Urkel and Family Matters, because it seems like every single sitcom has an episode where the family, the characters visit the city of Orlando, and it's usually tied into Disney World. So that's sort of the general sense of Orlando, is that it's just a theme park city. So I think when writers set out to tackle what is the real Orlando, I think almost inherently it becomes maybe a darker vision of the city, because they're trying to expose something that maybe we don't see too often. When we see Orlando in film and in literature, it is the veneer, it's the facade, it's very, very happy, and it usually has mouse ears. But when the writer sets out to tackle and show the honest side, the truth, it's going to be very different than that.
And I wonder, tell me about how the authors ended up writing about these specific places in Orlando. Was it up to them to decide, or how did you guide it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. At the start of the project, it was all done online. So at the start of the project, we created sort of a wish list. I wanted to see Beefy King. Unfortunately,
I love Beefy King.
Yeah, I love it too. Yeah. We didn't have any writers who actually tackled Beefy King, or my other choice, Appliance Direct, really wanted to see that depicted in literature. But we didn't have any authors that did that. We had a wish list. Writers could work with the wish list, or they could just tackle their own favorite places. And we had some authors like Ashley Nguanta, who chose to tackle sort of an entire area, Little Vietnam, and other authors like Hunter, who tackled an intersection, and other authors like Jared, who tackled one specific location, different neighborhoods, different businesses, and even a couple authors like John King, who wrote about a place called Crocodile World, which is sort of a caricature of, and it's not too hard to figure out what it's caricaturing, I guess, but a lot of different locations, neighborhoods, areas, businesses.
So we're talking about this new book that's coming out called 15 Views of Orlando. It's 15 short interwoven stories written by 15 authors connected to the city. And we're lucky on Intersection to have two of those writers in studio with us, Hunter Choate and J. Christopher Sylvia. And so I wonder, Hunter Choate, tell us where you wrote about, and maybe you could read us a passage.
Absolutely. My story is called The Gentlest of Bends, and the setting is the intersection of Orange Blossom Trail and Sand Lake Road. And with that said, here we go. A cluster of afternoon traffic rose up from the distance where the road was a shimmering black sea. Perkin hotboxed his cigarette and flicked loose the cherry in a burst of orange embers that ashed the sidewalk, then tucked the unsmoked portion into the front pocket of his t-shirt. He eyed the still roost of overhead stoplights and readied his need work, hungry sign. The lights burned from yellow to red, and oncoming cars slowed to a halt. Idling engines clanked and sputtered dark fumes that sharpened the air. The faces behind the windshields were solemn smudges of pinks and browns. A family of tourists sat motionless in their white rental. The gleaming hood of a silver Mercedes captured the sky and rendered it small. The passenger's side window of a blue F-150 pickup squeaked down. A feminine hand emerged from the open window and waved white as a sail. Perkin approached the fluttering. "Spare some change," he said.
What made you want to talk about this area and write about it?
Well, I think that my choice of story and the character really dictated that location for me. I knew that I wanted to have somebody that was unemployed, that was panhandling, and I knew that the intersection of OBT and Sand Lake Road would have some preconceived notions for people that are familiar with the area that I could play off of for different effects.
Well, great. Thanks for reading that. And
thank you.
Also, we have J. Christopher Sylvia. Tell us what you're going to write about, and then take it away.
My story is about a sort of a legendary, mythical gentleman's club in the area, and I found it a sort of a fascinating subject. So the story is called The Little Death. The Booby Trap was a club with two knocker-shaped domes that you could see from the highway. It wasn't actually called the Booby Trap anymore. It was open Tuesdays. Kevin parked out back by the fence. He didn't like his car to be right up front. Inside, the air was sweaty and hot. It was thick and made my throat tickle. There were only a few people inside. There was a group of cops all huddled around one table. A girl was dancing near their table, looking sort of confused. The bartender was checking her cell phone. Another girl was at the end of the bar wearing short shorts and a glittering cowboy hat, playing video poker. I'm going to get a girlie, said Kevin, surveying the room. All right, let's go find a girlie, I said, but Kevin shook his head. I think I should go by myself. Why don't you go over there? Kevin pointed to an empty booth on the other side of the bar. I sat down in the empty booth and really thought, really angry thoughts about Kevin. He never considered what I wanted. He always did what he wanted. Maybe I wanted to talk to girlies. He didn't care. You don't look like you're having any fun, honey. A lady was leaning over the back of the booth. She was wearing silk. I'm fine. It's really nice in here. All the strippers look very hot.
Fantastic. Well, certainly evocative, to say the least. Well, let me ask you, J. Christopher Sylvia, put you in the hot seat here. I mean, where does this come from?
You know, I love this idea of local legends, right? So this, you know, I think it's funny how we have this sort of like strip club renewal in Orlando at points, and I know that's probably not the most pleasant thing to talk about, but you know, I think it's funny how you'll drive down in some area and you'll see a club that sort of is boarded up, and then some months later the boards will be down and they'll have like sort of a limited schedule of engagements, like, oh, now we're open on Tuesdays from 2 to 4. You know, it's like, whoa, okay, that's sort of unusual, I guess, but I think it's a sort of a as the city is kind of renewing this idea that these places are sort of gone and resurrected, and you know, I find it fascinating.
Did you have to do personal research for that?
You know, I despite what this sounds like, I am not really a frequent gentlemen's club visitor. So.
Well, talk to me about these stories and how they are connected, because you know, if you read through, there are some recurring characters. Mm-hmm. Was that a necessity for the project, that character Perkins, mm-hmm. That Hunter was talking about? He crops up a little bit throughout this project.
Yeah, part of the conceit behind the project was first that each author would choose a different location, and that way we would create an overall portrait of the city. And the second real mandate that I gave to all of the authors was that each story had to be linked to the last in some way. The link could be very, very tiny. It could be an image. And I think Hunter just used an image from the previous story in his story. And some authors decided to go very direct. They would have the individual characters reappearing or individual conflicts reappearing. And so you'll see some characters appear in 3-4 stories. And in fact, the last story in the collection, Vanessa Blakesley, a very talented author here in town, brought together 4 or 5, maybe even 6 characters from the entire collection. So it's a loose link. It's not necessarily one overarching story, but they are all linked and they all exist in the same world.
What do you want people to walk away from with it?
I think for me, the big thing that I want people to take away, and I can only speak to my story personally, is that Orlando, like anywhere else, we have real people with real problems, and they deserve to have their stories told.
What about for you, Jay Christopher?
I just love for people to know that, you know, Orlando isn't just a swath of suburbs between, you know, theme parks and the beach. I completely agree with what Hunter said. I mean, there are real people here and real people in every place, and I think that maybe in a larger statement, the idea that that there's real people in every neighborhood everywhere that deserve in some sort of their own hero's song.
Nathan Hollick is editor of 15 Views of Orlando, that book coming out, as you heard him say, at the end of the month, but available right now, also electronically. Thanks for coming in, Nathan. Good to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks also to Hunter Choate and also to J. Christopher Sylvia, who are contributing authors. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Find out more by going online to WMFE.org/intersection. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Amy Green is the assistant producer. I'm Mark Simpson, and thanks for listening.